You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Have you ever sat down one evening and thought to yourself, that was a day? If you wrote about that day, could its events, its trials, tribulations, highs, lows, mysteries, revelations, fill an entire book? Our next guest has made an impressive literary career of filling books, big ones, with storytelling about a world of his own creation, told from the perspective of a span of individual days. The same is true from his newest book, a standalone story that takes place in one day in his fictional world. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of Wisconsin author Patrick Rothfuss, a reader of fantasy fiction yourself? Have you ever worked to create your own fantasy world for a role-playing game, for your own writing? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Wisconsin's own Patrick Rothfuss is the author of the King Killer Chronicle fantasy series. It kicked off with The Name of the Wind. His new book is called The Narrow Road Between Desires, set in the fictional world where his other novels take place. Fun fact, he was a guest on the pilot version of a radio show that eventually became this show. Pat, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, first off, I didn't know that. I didn't know that I was I was an early adopter, but also that was the best, nicest lead-in I have heard in a mortal age. I am so tickled and I'm like really kind of blushy right now.
Oh, stop.
it's true. I never actually realized that. Yeah, I guess I do frame things in terms of days, which sounds silly now that I kind of admit that that wasn't intentional.
Wow. And I'll credit to our producer, Tim Peterson. I've read your books, but I didn't really until I thought back. It's like, yeah, the novels were told. Yeah. Anyway, a lot of people in Wisconsin familiar with your work. For those who aren't, can you tell us a bit about the world that The Name of the Wind and the new book, The Narrow Road Between Desires, is set in?
That is a dangerous one, and I'll try to do it briefly.
How much time do we have? Yeah,
exactly. Everyone out there just heard me say briefly, and they're rolling their eyes. Fantasy... if you look at Tolkien, he wrote what is referred to as secondary world fantasy. It happens somewhere else. There's a lot of modern fantasy is written in this world, but different, or this world, but there's secrets. When I sat down to start this whole project, gosh, 20 years ago, I knew I wanted to tell a story in another world. But the thing that I wanted to avoid is something I've seen in so many of the books that I loved, but it broke my heart. At the end of The Lord of the Rings, Middle Earth is kind of done. The story exhausts the world. There can't ever be follow-ups because, like, the elves are leaving. And the story is so big that there's no room for more things to happen after it in the world without seeming anticlimactic. So when I started writing this story, I'm like, I want to tell a smaller story about a man's life. You know, what's like, I've heard it referred to as the backstage pass to the myth of the hero. But after I always thought when I'm done telling this person's story, there's more world, more places, more people. So that's my world. A fun place to explore, but hopefully big enough. I always hoped for multiple stories. That's not very descriptive at all.
That's okay. But I actually want to take it to this new book, The Narrow Road Between Desires. You've actually done exactly what you just talked about in this and a previous book, taken one character, a secondary character from the main arc, and said, in effect, what is a day in their life look like? And it's a very different feel and a very different voice, but it allows you to explore another part of that world you created.
And, you know, it was something I stumbled into with Slow Regard, the book that should never have been written and I never thought would be published, the book where nothing happens, but that I love it anyway. And, this one, at least I could think, well, people do want to show up for effectively... You know, you get to see a secondary character live their own life. There's a term for that sort of episode in a TV show, but I don't know it because I don't do TV shows.
I wanted to talk about the challenge of writing fantasy, and I'm always impressed with this fantasy and some science fiction where, as you said, it's set not in our world. where, in addition to telling a story, you have to answer a lot of questions about how that world works. But also, I mean, and some old science fiction is, hey, here's an encyclopedia chapter for the first chapter, so you know where we are. The challenge of, like, working all that world building in while still, you know, advancing a plot.
It is the persistent issue, and it's one, you know, we all love Granddaddy Tolkien. We're in his shadow, and his shadow is long. And I love The Lord of the Rings, read it every year as a kid. It's got fingerprints all over my heart. But good Lord, that book starts slow, right? And he's like, hey, there's a place, and they have birthday parties, and they give gifts, and they're called Mathomes, and there's a museum. And so this guy is going to have a birthday, and here's what that birthday is like. And you're like, Tolkien, it's been 50 pages. What's going on here? And so what it's talked about in this day and age is you make this world, because you have to make a world to tell a story in it. And then you're kind of proud of it, and you want to show it off, and you have to show it off. But, you know, the rookie mistake is to, again, follow a little too closely in Tolkien's footsteps, and you show everything off, and you're excited because your baby is very smart and pretty, and you really want to talk about the cool religion you made or the magic you have. And it's called the info dump. In my experience, the problem isn't making a cool world. The problem is making it and then shutting up about it and doing a story instead. And I'm afflicted with it as much as anyone, because I do a wild amount of world building.
Talking to Wisconsin author Patrick Rothfuss, author of the series that starts with The Name of the Wind. A new book set in that world is just out, The Narrow Road Between Desires. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Your questions, your experiences reading fantasy literature, and a question that I'm about to ask Patrick is, what kind of stuff do you like to read to your kids? Do you have fond memories of having things read to you by your parents growing up? Join in at 800-642-1234. Pat, you were mentioning your reading of The Lord of the Rings as a kid. I know you've talked online and elsewhere about, you know, what you like to read to your own kids. What is on your hit list? What kind of things do you look for to read to kids?
I do. You know, for a long time, for those of you out there that know what Goodreads is, I used to review a lot of books there. And then as I started to read more to my boys and look more at kids' books, I shifted almost entirely to sharing my many, many opinions about children's literature, because good Lord, if you're a careful parent who wants to limit a child's exposure to some really toxic cultural stuff, there's a lot to look out for in some of these classic books. But yeah, I never knew that Little House on the Prairie was real or a book until I already had kids. So I read all of them to the boys, editing on the fly to avoid, oof, there are some racist and sexist things in there. But still, they're fabulous. They're more fantastic than a lot of fantasy I've read. These days, though, my boys are 9 and 14. And there's very little, like, in terms of, like, age range that I wouldn't lay on them. You know, think of who their daddy is, right? So, I've read The Hobbit to them multiple times. They could practically sing along with the opening. Right now I'm rereading The Last Unicorn to them, one of my all-time favorite books. I read this book to them, only because on a lark, I was reading, Ursula K. Le Guin's, like, foundational, Wizard of Earthsea, which I love and they love, but it was not meant to be read out loud, and it was hard. And if you're doing it before bed, you don't want an extra job. And I'm like, maybe I could read them a little bit of Slow Regard, which I remembered being easy to read out loud because I did the audiobook. And I'm like, and I did it. And I immediately got self-conscious. And I said, you know what, boys, this was silly. I'm not going to read you my own. And they're like, please, please, please. And I read it. And they loved this story about nothing. They were so into it. And so I bounced this book off of them as well. And they helped me catch a few mistakes and they helped me work on the illustrations. So I read to them all the time. Not as much as I wish I would, but still an awful lot. Yeah.
We're talking to Wisconsin author Patrick Rothfuss about some of his storytelling craft, including speculative fiction and world building, and his new book. It's called The Narrow Road Between Desires. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest? Have you already picked up the new book? Are you a writer yourself? Do you need maybe some inspiration for your own creativity? And do you have favorite things to read to kids? Or do you have a favorite memory of being read to as a kid? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin author Patrick Rothfuss is with us talking about the craft of storytelling in his new book set in his fictional world. It's called The Narrow Road Between Desires. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. John is with us in Green Bay. John, hi.
Hello. I just wanted to share a quick story of my aunt reading Shel Silverstein poems to us, my sister and I, and how much we just enjoyed that experience, how his words brought those poems to our imagination. And I forgot the titles. It's Another Light in the Attic, something like that. Perhaps the author knows.
A Light in the Attic. Yeah.
And John, I got to ask before I let you go, have you passed those on to a new generation or do you plan to?
Yes, we've kept them and I read them to my kids, but now my kids are 19, 21, 23. So we'll see. They'll be held on to for another generation.
My kids are that age. They don't let me read to them anymore either. But I had a great aunt who read Shel Silverstein to us as a kid. It's the poems that aunts read to kids, apparently, Pat.
Oh, Shel Silverstein just gave me like a tingle of joy. The boys would read some of that to each other. Mm. I also stumbled onto videos of Shel Silverstein reading his own stuff, which was wild. Like, it was not what I expected because he was an intense man.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Pat, in the new book, I get a little bit of a fairy tale feel to it for a couple of reasons, I think. Do you look to the worlds of fairy tales and folklore for some of your inspiration?
Absolutely. And for this one in particular, I kind of put my foot in it because I'm like, oh, you know, I actually studied fairy tales. I used to collect fairy tales. I'm like, back in my arrogant youth, I'm like, I just want to read all of the classic fairy tales, get them under my belt. You can't. There's so many and from all different cultures. However, when I'm like, I'll draw on some of those elements. And, you know, if I'm trying to fit some of those things into my world is not the world of, you know, medieval Europe, mm-hmm. or where the Grimm brothers were, or, a lot of these, you know, this different mindset. So the cultural things don't fit together, but also trying to bring in and sort of be mindful of a different sort of morality, because these fairy tales were moral. Bruno Bettelheim wrote a great book. It's one of the few books written about fairy tales seriously, and it's called The Witch Must Die, because people think, oh, these were never meant for children. The thing is, yeah, they weren't meant just for children. Kids love them, and they don't mind terrible things in stories so long as the people who do terrible things are punished. And that sort of, it's reassuring because you're like, oh, there might be bad people, but they're going to get theirs. And like, and that is I'm not saying it's the best morality, but there's a moral compass in there. And like the the evil stepmother in Sleeping Beauty, at the end, she's safe. She's back. She's getting married. And at the wedding, they heat up a pair of iron shoes by the fire, make her wear them and dance until she dies. So like, that's old Testament morality there. But that doesn't really, you know, fit in the world I created. And it's not necessarily the morality that I want to spread in my own fiction. So, I mean, a little taste of that is fine, but I don't want that to be the end all be all. So trying to be socially responsible with what I'm sharing with the world, it's a little tricky because the old folk tales, they were dark, and fairies weren't really interested in important stuff like consent. And so I had some work to do there. Yeah.
Let's go back to our callers. Barbara is with us in Madison. Barbara, hi.
Hi. I just want to tell Patrick how much I enjoy his writing. I picked up The Name of the Wind. I don't know why I picked it, you know, but I loved it so much. I shared it with my whole family. And I just finished reading The Slow Regard again because I liked that so much. I saw it at the library. And now the Mystery to Me just called and said, your new book is in. Could I come and get it? So that's what I'm doing.
Barbara, who gave you a call?
The Murder to Me bookstore, I think she was referring to.
Oh, I love them. Yeah.
Barbara, thanks a lot for that call. Patrick, you're at a point where you've got lots of fans out there. What does it feel like to, I don't know, just to have people out there looking forward to something, as Barbara did clearly, to picking up that book at the bookstore today?
You know, the proper answer is sort of the chirpy Hollywood interview answer, which is to say, oh, it's so great. And it is. I'm not saying that's not a true answer, but the really true answer is it's been like almost a decade since I published a book, and I've really felt bad about that, and I've beaten myself up about it. And there's books I've wanted to write, and there's books that people want to read from me. And then I do this book, and I know it's not the book some people want or wish for. And so it's not healthy, but I will admit, like, somebody asked me this exact question. Hey, you're getting a book out. How does it feel? Pretty good. And I'm like, actually, I have a sense of dread.
Oh, no.
Because I'm worried people will just be upset. It's not what they want. But hearing from people like that, I remember, like, you don't do things for the people that are going to be angry at you. Like, that shouldn't be my deciding thing. It's been so nice to hear it again and again as I put the book out. Some people are salty. It's not what they wanted, or it's been too long for them. But there's so many people who are kind and thoughtful, and they understand that life gets in the way. And it does me a world of good to hear that people still think of me fondly, honestly. Yeah.
Barbara, thanks a lot for the call. I think I said Murder to Me, Mystery to Me bookstore. Talking to Patrick Rothfuss, author of the King Killer Chronicle fantasy series. His latest book is called The Narrow Road Between Desires. It's been a while since we talked, Patrick, but I dimly recall that you really liked recommending books and sharing the stuff you're loving reading with other humans. You got any suggestions for us these days?
You know, when you're promoting a book... You know what your PR people hate is when you talk about another book that's coming out right now. But man, I'll do it every time. If you haven't read Murderbot, the Murderbot Diaries, I think I love it as much as I've loved anything that I've read that I've picked up new in these last 5 years. And you might think, what, Murderbot? I read a lot. And I don't know if I have loved anything as much as I've loved that. I've read it multiple, multiple times. The audiobook is stunning by Kevin R. Free. It's by Martha Wells. And the newest one, Me and My Boys, honestly, I've been kind of excited and kind of dreading my own book release. The book release we've really been looking forward to in this household with untrammeled joy is Martha Wells' new Murderbot. Start at the beginning, though, and Trust me, it's gorgeous. I've never empathized with a character as much as I've empathized with Murderbot.
All right. We'll apologize to your PR people, Patrick.
No, I love it. Thank you for giving me the chance, because I'll talk about Murderbot all day. I would list 100 books, but I know that I shouldn't mention a book that's coming out literally right now. But absolutely, pick that one up. Then you can try mine.
And then go ahead. Yeah. Well, actually, I just want to ask briefly in our last half a minute or so, Patrick, you've taught creative writing, including at your alma mater, UW Stevens Point, over the years. Quick bit of inspiration for somebody who wants to write for, you know, maybe they're going to publish a book, maybe it's just for fun, a quick bit of inspiration for them.
I'll say this. There's no right way to do it. And anyone who says this is the way, take their advice with a grain of salt. Instead, if you want to make a world, don't feel like you got to do what Tolkien did. He was a linguist, so he did languages. He was a historian, so he based it on the Eddas. If you love stamp collecting and butterflies, and that's what you're into, make a world that centers around that, and I will be there for your weird Lepidoptera fantasy novel, man.
Pat, we'll leave it there. Good to talk to you again.
So good to talk to you.
That's Wisconsin-born and raised Patrick Rothfuss, author of the Kingkiller Chronicle Fantasy Series, which kicked off with The Name of the Wind. We talked to him about his latest book called The Narrow Road Between Desires and many other things as well. If you have a favorite book that you like reading to kids, email ideas@WPR.org. We can share it on a future program. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, find out what causes behavioral addictions to things like gambling, sex, food, and more, and what kind of treatments are out there if you or a loved one are dealing with a problem. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday with advice on cooking for the holiday season when you or one of your guests has diabetes. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Earlier this year, a major survey found that airline passengers in the U.S. are more dissatisfied than they were last year. And the U.S. Transportation Department just announced that consumer complaints about airlines have nearly doubled since last year. From rising fares to shrinking legroom to risk of delays and cancellations, the experience of booking and taking a flight can range from inconvenient to outright miserable. Our next guest says it doesn't have to be that way. In his new book, he looks at how we got here when it comes to airline policy. He says there are a lot of changes that would improve things. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you've taken a flight recently, what was your experience like? Did the major flight cancellations late last year affect your holiday plans and maybe the plans you're making this year? Do you have a smaller airport in your community that's seen reduced service or now no service at all? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ganesh Sitaraman is a professor of law at Vanderbilt University, director of the Vanderbilt Policy Accelerator. His new book is called Why Flying is Miserable and How to Fix It. Ganesh, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Before we get into the policy story you tell in your book, miserable? I mean, people might think, I don't love flying, but is it really that bad?
I think it really is. And it's bad for both passengers and it's bad for the country. You know, for passengers, we all deal with the complicated number of fare classes and extra fees when checking a bag or picking your seat. Then there's the shrinking legroom that we've seen over the decades, plus the fact that you rarely get food or anything on planes anymore. And when you look more broadly to the country, there are also real problems in the airline industry. Delays, cancellations, having to connect through big cities all the time instead of being able to take nonstop flights, and the boom and bust cycle that we've been in, where in some years airlines are doing really well, but then when there's a big crisis, they need a taxpayer bailout or support program. And I think that shows the fragility of the industry and the fact that we're not getting the best quality service. So the combination of those two things, yeah, I do think flying is miserable.
I want to take us to a turning point you describe in the book where we'd had a system of federal regulation, at least of interstate airlines and flights, And then we deregulated very quickly. Can you paint us a picture of what Ganesh things looked like before that deregulation? How did our airline system work?
Yeah, from the 1930s to the 1970s, there was a system that I think of as a stable, reliable system. And Congress in the 1930s decided that they wanted the airline system to be able to serve the whole country, including small places, small towns. And we have a really big country. And so they wanted to make sure every part of the country had access to air service. They also wanted an airline industry that was going to be stable and reliable, one that didn't need tons of subsidies, wasn't going to face a lot of bankruptcies or bailouts. And so they tried to have a system of regulated competition in which there was some competition, but not so much that airlines would go under, and also not so little that there would be a monopolist or just a few airlines that were dominant. And the way they achieved that system was by having a federal regulator allocate routes to the different airlines, so each airline would be assigned to where they were going to fly, and set prices also that were just and reasonable for consumers. And during this period of about 40 years, we saw expanded number of people, passengers flying. We saw prices going down. And there were big innovations like the jet age starting up, the move from propeller planes to jets that we have now, and also competition on service quality. And so that was this stable period. And it was one in which members of Congress and policymakers really said that this is a transportation infrastructure that is critical to our society, and we need to regulate it more like a public utility, something that's essential to a lot of different communities and individuals.
Then here comes this deregulation urge. People from Ralph Nader and Senator Ted Kennedy to very conservative economists at the University of Chicago united in this idea that deregulation is going to make things even better. What were the promises? And your whole book is mainly saying these promises didn't come true, but what was the case that they made?
Well, the advocates for deregulation in the 70s, they looked at the regulated competition model and said, this looks like a cartel, and cartels are bad. We should have competition. And they thought that if we just let airlines fly wherever they want, whenever they want, and to charge whatever they want, that we'd have a much better system. There would be dozens of airlines flying around efficiently. One person even suggested up to 200 airlines would be efficiently operating, and that there wouldn't really be any downsides, not in quality of service or loss to cities. And that was a pretty good pitch. Congress bought the pitch and deregulated the airlines in the 1970s, in 1978 specifically, under Jimmy Carter. And as I argue in the book, we didn't really get what they were promising. Ultimately, we ended up, instead of in that dream world, in something more like the Hunger Games, where in the early 80s, you saw really cutthroat competition between new upstarts who were serving high volume routes and offering low prices with no frills and no unionized workers. But then the big airlines fought back, and they would undercut them in price and push them out of those routes. And over the course of the 80s, there were dozens of bankruptcies and mergers, and we actually ended up with consolidation once again, low competition, and the same big airlines that were running the show in the 70s were running it by the end of the 80s. Just this time, they were unregulated instead of regulated.
Ganesh Sitaraman is with us talking about his new book, Why Flying is Miserable and How to Fix It. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Ganesh, before we go to our callers, one big consequence you highlight in the book, and one that gave some members of Congress who supported deregulation buyer's remorse, is that a lot of small and even mid-sized cities saw declines in the amount of service they got, or even airports no longer served by passenger air. What happened?
This is a really important point, that under the regulated system, because the regulators allocated routes, airlines were required to serve some places that weren't always going to have a lot of volume of people flying there. But we understood that it was important for them to have access to air travel. And they would also get to serve some places that were going to have a lot of traffic. When deregulation happened, there was no obligation to serve those places anymore. And so airlines could cut back on the places that had lower volumes and invest more in the places with higher volumes. And so we saw this reshaping of the geography of air travel that in many ways over the last four decades has harmed smaller cities, smaller communities, rural places. And exactly as you said, you know, even in the as early as the 1980s, there were members of Congress regretting their votes. I talk in the book about Robert Byrd, senator from West Virginia, who apologized for his vote and wished he could go back and re-regulate the airlines because of the devastating effects it had had on his community and so many other small communities and states.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Vicki is with us in Mequon. Vicki, hello.
Hi there. And if I could preface my comment about a recent flight I took with, I was a Pan Am flight attendant. If you remember, Pan Am World mm-hmm. Airways was the premier airline, and I took pride for 10 years serving passengers in economy on 14-hour flights. People got off and they were happy. I just took a flight from Chicago to Rome on American. It was an Airbus A320. There's no room for your butt. There's no room for your feet. There's no room for your elbows. I couldn't even reach down to try to get my book out from under the seat in front of me. You have movies and you have other things. I think passengers would be much happier with space.
Vicki, thanks a lot for sharing that. Before and after Ganesh, can you talk about some of the changes that led to what Vicki saw as a transatlantic flight attendant and now as an air traveler in a much smaller seat?
Well, thanks, Vicki, for sharing your story. And I think it's just all too common for all of us that we've seen over the last few decades seats shrinking. And it's not a perception. They actually have a shrunk in size over the years. And that's a real problem for exactly the reasons you say. It's gotten a lot less convenient for passengers, and it causes people to be more frustrated. And often, you know, sometimes they'll take that out on people like you who were flight attendants and who are really doing their best to provide good quality service to everyone on the airplanes. And so I think this is really a core part of the story, that if the airlines are competing in a way that is just to get more people in and make more money that way, rather than providing a good quality service, you know, of course, if there's no competition, they're going to, you know, jam us in as much as they can with the smallest seats that they can. And that's where we are now, because if you want to go from Chicago to Rome, well, how else are you going to get there? You can't swim, and it'll take too long to drive and then take a ship. We really need airlines. And when we have few choices, there's little we can do.
Vicki, thanks for that call. Ganesh Sitaraman is with us, professor of law at Vanderbilt University. His new book is called Why Flying is Miserable and How to Fix It. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you agree that air travel has gotten worse over time, whether you're looking at that as a passenger or someone who works in the industry? Would you want to see a change in the way airlines are regulated? Do you have questions for our guest? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Vanderbilt Law Professor Ganesh Sitaraman about his new book, Why Flying is Miserable and How to Fix It, which proposes airline policy solutions aimed at improving the air travel experience. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the industry, your experiences as a passenger, pilot, mechanic, steward, you name it. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Bill is with us in Madison. Bill, hi.
Hey, how's it going, Rob? I think your guest has a pretty solid handle on what's going on in the industry, and I'm looking forward to reading his book. So I'm kind of in between those categories. My best friend is a flight attendant, so I've gotten to hear a lot of stories from the inside of what's going on there. First, I'd like to say that flight attendants are there for your safety first, and that's their primary job. And the drinks and other things that come along with that are secondary and are just nice to have. That's not their primary function. And the other thing I was wondering if folks knew is that most flight attendants who work in the commercial aviation industry get their schedules as a result of a competitive bidding process, which is largely based on seniority.
Bill, thanks for the call. Ganesh, I don't know if you want to get into the intricacies of how flight attendants work, but you'd spend a lot of time talking about the impact of deregulation on the people who work for airlines.
Yeah, and it's a really important part of the story. You know, to be a pilot, a flight attendant, a mechanic actually requires a great deal of skill and talent. And we should value that because, as the caller said, you know, there's the real importance of safety in this industry that we all understand and I think take very seriously. But what happened after deregulation was in the quest to cut costs in order to operate in a competitive system, you actually saw airlines, big and small, working to reduce pay, reduce benefits for their employees. And this led to a lot of conflict between labor and management in the 1980s. And even Senator Ted Kennedy from Massachusetts, who was one of the biggest proponents of airline deregulation in the 70s, by the end of the 80s, was fuming over how upset workers in the industry were at what had happened. And, you know, he said this isn't what was promised to him about what was going to happen after deregulation with the changes for people who work in the industry. And so, you know, today, I think one of the most important things is thinking about how do we ensure that we have a set of people who work in this industry who are really valued and are paid well for the work that they do, because it is essential to keeping us safe when we fly.
Thanks for that call, Bill. Mary joins us now in Fitchburg. Mary, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. And I appreciate that you guys are talking about this today.
What did you want to bring up?
Well, I am from the hometown of Delta, where Delta started in Louisiana. And I always find it really ironic that we, you know, they started there, but it is so expensive to get home and to find a reasonable flight, especially with two kids and one of them very small, that are at decent times of the day that are below $800 for a round trip ticket. It's just almost impossible to get home with those prices.
So what do you end up doing, Mary? Just not going home, or do you fly sort of near as you can and drive over? What, how have you tackled that?
It's a combination. I mean, we search for whatever is most economical. I have made many 14 to 16 hour trips home in a car. Mm-hmm. But I have an infant now, so it's just not super reasonable. So the last time I flew, I was getting home close to midnight with, you know, my two kids. So it was just, it's unfortunate, but we do our best, but it's just so hard to get home because of those types of pricing.
Mary, thanks a lot for that call. This is super common. You write, Ganesh, even when smaller communities or, you know, what we think of like as medium, even sized communities have that air service, it's often hub based. It's often, as Mary finds, very expensive to get from point A to point B.
This is one of the real problems that's happened is we've had this consolidation in the airline industry, which is really efficient and cost savings for the airlines. You know, if every city connects through Atlanta, in the case of Delta, they run a big operation in Atlanta, but they don't have to provide nonstop service between two cities. They make you connect. But the other problem that happens is if you're a smaller city and you don't have a lot of competition, they're really the only game in town. And so the combination of those two things means higher prices, more inconvenience, and it's just harder to get places in a more affordable way. And that's where we are today because of the deregulatory system that left us in a place where the airlines get to pick where they want to fly and how much they're going to charge.
Thanks for sharing that experience, Mary. Ganesh Sitaraman is with us. His new book is called Why Flying is Miserable and How to Fix It. Back to your calls. KC is with us here in Wisconsin. KC, hello.
Hey, good afternoon.
What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I think the main thing right now that's frustrating me more than anything is the rampant violence that's going on in commercial flights these days, and everybody is asking, why is this so prevalent? Why is this happening so often? And me, I've been a frequent flyer for going on my 40th year, and by a frequent flyer, I mean virtually every week for a minimum of 4 flights a week. But the reason for all the violence on airlines these days is, to me, pretty obvious. It's just changed so much in the last 30 to 40 years that right now we're in a condition where you can take any species of animal.
We just have a few moments left. Casey, hit us with the cause of the problems.
Okay, real fast. You take any species of animal, deprive them of food, put them in an overcrowded area, deprive them of all comforts, and eventually they begin to devour each other.
Casey, I gotcha. Ganesh, we keep hearing complaints about unruly passengers. Casey says, well, it's the overcrowding and the poor service that the system has set up for us.
This is one of the real challenges of the system we have now is, you know, when we don't regulate these things, we have this race to the bottom in the quality of service. And that has real downsides, downsides for flight attendants, for other passengers, for the experience, for everyone. And, you know, that's part of the reason why we need to change things up.
Thanks for that call. And let's spend our last few minutes talking about the kind of changes you'd like to see, Ganesh. I don't know if we would go exactly to the system of regulation we had before, but what kind of starting points would you like to see?
Well, I have three principles, and I think there are a lot of ways we can achieve these. The first is no more flyover country. We should have a country where there's service to lots of different places. And one way we could do that is a kind of NFL-style draft, where there are a set of cities, and the biggest airlines each have to pick cities from the list and serve them at affordable rates with some reasonable frequency. The second principle is no bailouts, no bankruptcies. I actually want there to be a reliable, stable, profitable airline industry, and I think we should all want that because it is an essential service. And one way we could move in that direction is requiring airlines to have crisis management plans so that if there is a big shock like COVID-19 again, they're ready and know what they're going to do for 6 months or a year, and maybe have a rainy day fund as a requirement too, so that we don't have to have taxpayer support programs come in. And then the third principle is fair and transparent pricing. We need to have a much simpler system than we currently have on pricing, where the prices can change based on the day of the week when you buy the tickets. And I think if we were to do things in all three of these areas, what we would see is that together they would really shift incentives even on things like the experience inside the airplane too. And that the combination of those things would create a structure that works very differently than the one we have right now.
And just our last minute or so, Ganesh, government regulation became a dirty phrase around the time we're talking about, 70s and 80s. Do you think there would be an appetite for the people who'd have to make these decisions, including in Congress, to make these changes?
Well, I think this is one of the places where there should really be a lot of bipartisan support. And the reason why is pretty simple. There are people all over this country who fly in every state and every congressional district from all different kinds of perspectives. And, you know, one thing that I've heard from our callers today and across the board is people aren't happy about this. And that's a lot of voters who, if we all call our Congress people and tell them to act, you know, hopefully we can create the pressure to get the kind of change we need.
Ganesh, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Ganesh Sitaraman is a professor of law at Vanderbilt University, director of the Vanderbilt Policy Accelerator, and we've been talking about his new book. It's called Why Flying is Miserable and How to Fix It. It looks at the history of airline policy in the United States, proposes solutions for making flying a better experience for everyone. You can keep sharing your thoughts, maybe your experiences, for better or worse, with air travel. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.